Perfect. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining the call on GiveWell's 2016 charity recommendations. I'm Catherine Hollander, an outreach associate at GiveWell, and with me are Natalie Crispin, a senior research analyst, and Ellie Hassenfeld, one of GiveWell's co-founders. This call is being recorded. We generally default to publishing information publicly while also being willing to keep information confidential when requested by specific parties. So consistent with this, we're planning to record this call and post the recording and possibly a transcript on our website. That being said, if you make any comments that you'd like us to remove, please let us know after the call and we'd be happy to do so. Just to quickly run through the process for asking questions on the call, Ellie is planning to make brief remarks at the beginning of the call and then open up the floor for questions. Right now, you're all muted. We're planning to mute all participants to keep the audio quality good. And there will be two main ways to ask questions. One is that if you're joining the conference on your computer, either in addition to or in lieu of using your phone, you can use the chat interface on the right side of the screen to announce that you have a question. You can also email info, I-N-F-O, at givewell.org that you have a question. In both cases, please let us know your phone number so that we know whose line to unmute to ask the question. You can also let me know if you prefer that we read the question out loud, and we're happy to do that as well. And if you join using your computer, you don't have to share your phone number. Finally, you don't have to write out a full question, but if you share the general topic, that will allow us to group the questions that are similar together. So I think with that, I will turn it over to Ellie to give the update on our new top charities.
Thanks, Catherine. This is Ellie Hassenfeld, GiveWell's co-founder. I hope that we'll use the majority of this time to answer questions that you have. But to start things off, I wanted to give a brief summary of our recommendations, the process we used to come to these recommendations, some brief remarks on the strengths and weaknesses of the top charities relative to each other, and then just give a word about some of our plans for future research. And once that's all done, we'd be very happy to hear questions on anything I've said, but also really anything that is connected to the world of GiveWell and our research. We know that we put a lot of written material out there, and we view these conversations as a great way to have a more informal conversation and answer as much as possible whatever is on your mind about the work that we do. So in the recommendations that we released earlier this week, we continued to recommend the four top charities that we had recommended in previous years, and we also added three more organizations to the list: the N Fund and Sightsavers, which support deworming programs, and Malaria Consortium for its work on seasonal malaria chemo prevention, which is a program that provides pills to prevent malaria in parts of Africa during the time of year when malaria is most common. And so those three new organizations were added to our pre-existing list of the Against Malaria Foundation, which supports malaria net distributions in sub-Saharan Africa, the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative and Deworm the World, which both focus on deworming programs. Again, these are programs that treat parasitic infections in children. And then finally, GiveDirectly, an organization that just directs cash directly to some of the poorest people in the world. Our process is really driven by three primary evaluative criteria. They are evidence of effectiveness, which is the question of the extent to which a program, we ask, does a program actually have an impact and how large is that impact? Cost effectiveness, you know, what is the cost to have that impact? Where do you get the most bang for your buck? And then finally, room for more funding, which is the ability of an organization to utilize additional funding to have additional impact. We tend to start by looking at academic or other non-charitable organization-specific literature to get a sense of the answer to these questions. And so we will, for example, look at the evidence of effectiveness, try to model the cost effectiveness, and assess the global need for additional funding for a program like distributing malaria nets. And once we've come up with the set of programs, which we see as most promising, we deem these programs priority programs, and then look for charitable organizations that are implementing them, which we then similarly assess on the same criteria. To what extent can they demonstrate that they're having the sort of effect that we hope for, that they're doing so cost effectively, and that they can utilize additional funding to accomplish the goals that they have. So in this past year, we knew from previous years that malaria nets and deworming programs were highly cost effective. We kept looking for additional organizations implementing those. And then we also determined seasonal malaria chemo prevention to be a priority program, which led us to evaluate malaria consortium's work on that program. And there were other charities and programs which we considered, none of which made it all the way to top charity status. Very happy on this call to go into any more detail on that if folks are interested. I think it'd be worthwhile for me to just briefly summarize some of the strengths and weaknesses of these organizations relative to each other. Sort of, on balance, when we look at our criteria, evidence, cost effectiveness, and need for funding, and then also take into account funding that we already expect to go to these organizations due to our influence and others, what we recommend to donors is giving 75% of their donation to the Against Malaria Foundation and 25% to the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative. So that's sort of our bottom line summary level recommendation for folks who just want to really follow exactly what we would do. But to go into more detail on how the organizations stack up against each other. So, to start off with GiveDirectly, which gives out cash directly to very poor people, they stand out in a few ways. First, if you want to be highly confident that you're having significant impact, we think GiveDirectly and cash transfers are the best way to go. It has fewer risks, and the risks are smaller of having no impact than our other recommendations do. We also think that of the organizations we recommend, GiveDirectly overall is the strongest as an organization, just in terms of our confidence and its ability to monitor itself, hire additional staff, scale up its work. And finally, it has a huge amount of need for more funding. We're highly confident that it could absorb and utilize very significant sums, and far more than we anticipate it receiving in the coming months. The weakness for GiveDirectly and cash transfers is that we think it is giving out cash is less cost effective, all told, than the other recommendations that we're making. The next program that I just want to talk about is deworming. And deworming programs, which are implemented by four of our recommended charities, we think it could be the biggest impact per dollar. It's extremely cheap to provide deworming treatment for children, less than a dollar per child, and it may have significant long-term effects. The finding that we put the most weight on in our analysis is that it can cause an increase of 10 to 20% in income for people who were dewormed as children when they're adults. And that finding is from the sort of gold standard in research, the randomized controlled trial, where that finding comes from. But, with deworming programs, we think there is more risk that one might have limited or no or non-significant impact by giving to deworming. The evidence is complicated and it is far from a sure thing. And so we see deworming as having some possibility of extremely significant impact, while having a risk of having very little impact, but we see it as very promising on overall expected value. So if you're looking for certainty, we would not recommend deworming. Instead, we'd recommend our other organizations. Broadly speaking, our deworming charities have less overall room for more funding than our other recommendations. The exception to that is the end fund, which, you know, we think likely does have significant room for more funding, but because it's a newer recommendation, we're not as confident about its ability and the way in which it would use additional funds as we are in our other recommendations. And then finally, there are the two malaria focus groups, you know, one which supports malaria nets to prevent malaria by controlling mosquitoes, and the other which prevents malaria through the mass administration of malaria treatment medicine. You know, these groups are focused on saving lives. While they, you know, they also prevent and reduce cases of malaria, which can have, you know, debilitating effects. But the primary effect we see is that they avert deaths of young children. And so if your philosophical values lead you to really want to avert deaths, then you certainly should be looking at the malaria focus groups as opposed to the other ones we recommend, which are life-improving, not life-saving organizations. You know, I think in some ways the malaria groups are in the middle of the deworming and the cash transfer ones on the other strengths and weaknesses we talked about. We think they are more likely to have significant impact. So the, you know, one's confidence could be higher in the malaria groups than in deworming, but they're certainly less certain, and we are less confident of that impact than we would with something as straightforward as cash transfers. We think that both Malaria Consortium, which is a newer group for us, and the Against Malaria Foundation, which we followed for years, both of them, we believe, have significant room for more funding and would utilize additional funds well. And we don't think that they're going to receive all the funds they can use, you know, in the coming months. Finally, and you know, just want to remind you, pause here and remind you to send in questions or chat questions so we can make sure to answer them as they come through. Now I just want to, and to do that, you can either use that chat feature on the side or email info@givewell.org. But before we do that, I just wanted to very briefly touch on some of our plans for the future. So on the research side of things, the biggest change in the last couple of years is that we've launched a program that we had been calling GiveWell Experimental. And the idea there was to provide grants to organizations and projects that would support the development of future GiveWell top charities. And so this could be in the form of supporting the sort of research that our recommendations rely on, for example, additional randomized controlled trials of programs that we're highly interested in. Or it could be giving startup funding to a group that's trying to get off the ground and implement a program that we think has strong evidence behind it. And, you know, happy to answer more questions. All the details of the work we've done in this area is on our website. We're also, you know, a big part of our work is assessing the evidence for programs. And to date, we've largely relied on randomized controlled trial evidence because that's the sort of evidence that our staff has had the capabilities to assess. But there are, you know, many other sorts of evidence and, of programs that are not quite as clear to assess as randomized controlled trials, but could demonstrate significant impact. And so we're now in the process of trying to hire a senior fellow. And, you know, the intention is to hire an economist with a very strong background in development economics to help us evaluate the sorts of programs and the types of studies that we haven't had the capacity to evaluate in the past. And then finally, you know, we hope that we think we're coming to a point where our product, you know, the recommendations we make to our donors as top charities is really maturing. And we're hopeful that we're reaching a point where we can devote some more of our activity and our energy to outreach, to reaching more donors. You know, to date, we've spent virtually all of our our capacity on research and have devoted very little proactive time to outreach. And I felt very fortunate to have as many people find us and give to our recommendations as we have. But I think we've finally reached the point where we may have the right staff set up and the product has reached a point where it's time to devote some more attention to outreach. So now I'm going to pause and hopefully we can turn things over to all of you and get into some questions.
Great. So as a reminder, from the top of the call, you know, there's two ways to ask a question. One is through emailing info@givewells.org, and the other is by using the chat interface on the right side of the screen. Again, please share your phone number in both cases so that I know who to unmute, or just let me know if you prefer that Ellie or I read the question. You're currently all muted, so I'm going to turn us over to the first question, which is a deworming RCT question from Chuck. So Chuck, I am unmuting you now. All right, Chuck, are you there?
He's also muted. Hi, you guys.
Hi, we hear you.
First of all, great format. Thank you very much. So you answered one of my questions in your introduction, which is the primary effect you're finding is on improvement in later income potential. How many, you know, how good is the RCT evidence around this? Are there, is it, you know, do you have one, two, three, four RCTs that confirm this? And how consistent is the impact you see across those different data sources?
Yeah, so it's a great question. The evidence in the scheme of things is relatively limited. It primarily comes from one trial, one experiment that was conducted in rural Kenya in the late 1990s, where researchers have followed the participants for years and, you know, were able to follow up with them years later to see about their income. I think that there are reasons to be more skeptical and see the evidence as less strong than just a single randomized controlled trial, but also some reasons to see it as even stronger than that would imply. Which I'll talk about very briefly, and just note that we're planning to publish a little bit more material on this in the coming weeks because it's something that we dove into with greater intensity over the last several months. So I think the reason first to just be more skeptical of this single RCT evidence is that there's really only one experiment that we know of where they looked for long-term effects of a deworming program. And, you know, that experiment finds these big income effects. But there are many trials where they looked for short-term effects from deworming programs on measures like height, you know, weight, other cognitive performance. And as far as we can tell, none of those have found any effects that are nearly as strong as the long-term income effect is. And so I think that there is reason to be cautious in interpreting this single RCT's result because the consistency and the magnitude of the short-term effects don't seem consistent with a long-term effect that is as large as this study implies. Now, on the flip side, there are a couple other studies or trials that were, or I should say, just assessments done of this same randomized control trial, which I think do serve to corroborate its effect to some extent. And so one is, you know, during, so one thing that, one kind of additional trial is during this experiment, the researchers embedded a second trial within the treatment group where they required people to pay additional, pay for deworming pills at some point. And so they had an additional RCT embedded in the existing RCT where deworming pills were given out for free. And this additional embedded RCT had much smaller sample size, so the effect is not as clear, and it's not itself statistically significant, but it is consistent with the same effect found by the sort of broader, larger scale study. And then second, there was another study that was done looking at the children who were born in the same areas as the deworming experiment was happening, but they were too young to receive the treatment themselves. And the idea is that if a young child's older sibling is dewormed, then they themselves are less likely to get these parasitic infections. And the paper shows outcomes of children born one, two, three years before the experiment started, then the year of the experiment, the year right after the experiment, and then several years into the future. And you see a large jump for the younger siblings of the study participants in the years that the study was taking place. And so, you know, while it is not directly, you know, it's another way of asking, is it possible that what this randomized control trial is picking up is actually something that's perhaps not due to the deworming program, but instead due to other local factors? And in that case, we think this does a decent job supporting the notion that it wasn't due to something else. Sorry about that.
Echo, I don't know where that's coming from. And Chuck, it looks like you have one other quick question on GiveDirectly, and it looks like we've had a few on that, so I think yours would be a nice kickoff to that as well. Do you mind asking that one now?
It was just a very specific question, which is how much do they give you?
They give approximately $1,000 to each family that they're serving.
That's in their standard program. They're also starting an additional program now, a universal basic income program, where the structure of the transfers is different, and it's different across a couple of arms, but the basic one is to provide probably monthly transfers over an extended period of time. And those transfers will be set to be a portion of their overall per capita income.
Yeah, a little bit more like the original Mexico idea. About that $1,000 produces roughly about how much income benefit? You know, what's the return, if you will?
So the way we see it is that, you know, we expect some portion of that $1,000 to be consumed, some portion of that $1,000 to be invested. The most common investment, or quote investment, is people who buy an iron roof to replace their thatched roof, which then enables them to not have to pay every several months to replace their thatched roof. And that itself is generating the equivalent of a return. And I believe that it is, you know, roughly speaking, and I'd have to look up the numbers to get it right, but my recollection is around 50% of the money invested, 50% consumed, 5-0, and then the iron roof produces a return of around 10 to 20% per year.
And in the places that they're working, the per capita income, we don't have great data on this, but seems to be around $200 to $250 a year. And so these are household level grants, so it's roughly doubling their income for the year in which they receive the grant.
Thanks.
Just one more thing I wanted to add briefly on the deworming point, which is just, you know, it's complicated. There really are two camps now of folks. You know, there are the deworming advocates, there are the deworming skeptics. We find ourselves somewhere in the middle where we're very focused on deworming's expected value, you know, recognizing that there are reasons to doubt, but the intervention seems cheap enough that it seems to have a strong return for the amount invested. And we are planning to release additional information that we're going to put on our blog in the next few weeks that goes into more detail and explains more fully the studies and the topics that I was describing briefly before.
We have another question related to GiveDirectly's basic income trial, which is, does the GiveWell recommendation for GiveDirectly extend the GiveDirectly basic income trial?
So it's a good question. For those who don't know, one of the big programs GiveDirectly is now implementing is a $30 million trial where they are raising that money so that they can guarantee people in the areas of Kenya that they're serving a basic income of, I believe, like the equivalent of per capita income per day for 10 years, and then trying to see whether that has, you know, large long-term effects by guaranteeing people the, you know, that they will have income. Our recommendation is not looking directly at that basic income trial. Our expectation is that GiveDirectly is independent of any recommendation from us going to be able to raise the funds that it needs for that basic income trial. Though I should say that, you know, they have not raised all those funds to date. They still have some degree of a funding gap for it, but like I said, we guess that they will. And so instead, we focused our work on what we see as the most likely use of additional funds to GiveDirectly, which is to support their standard cash transfer model.
Great. So I think for the next question, we will go to Kostin, who has a question about education-based charitable efforts and GiveWell's evaluation of effectiveness of long-term projects. Let's see, I don't have a number associated with that, and I'm not seeing that name appear on the list. So Ellie, maybe you can answer that from sort of the general education-based charitable efforts and GiveWell's evaluation of effectiveness of long-term projects.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a really good question. I mean, I think as when people look at our recommendation, it's quite clear that we, to date, have recommended organizations that are focused on health programs primarily, though we see deworming as an income-increasing intervention ultimately, and then cash transfers. And we do not have any recommendations that focus on education programs. We have a few questions that we'd like to resolve with respect to education interventions. I think the primary conceptual question is, you know, to what extent does improving or supporting education in various ways improve long-term life outcomes in the developing world? And, you know, that's, there's both a question of implementation. So, for example, if you build schools or give out textbooks or, you know, what have you, does that ultimately lead to improving? All right, we're getting another little echo on the line, so we're just going to wait a second.
I'm going to mute you again, but ping me in the chat if you'd like to ask a follow-up question, and we'll see if that resolves the echo.
So one question is just on the sort of, does the program implemented have the desired effect on something measurable, like test scores? And then a separate question is, what do those improvements in test scores mean for people's long-term outcomes? And I think that many of us have an intuition that improved education could lead to much improved life outcomes. So I think that we sitting here, us in San Francisco, are, you know, knowing that we are thousands of miles away and living in a very different context than the people we're trying to help, think we should at least be cautious about assuming that impacts that we could have in a very different society, in a very different context, would have similar impacts to what our intuitions might tell us would work, you know, here, you know, given our context. And so that's one of the reasons. Those two questions when we first looked at this back in 2009, find, you know, strong, essentially randomized controlled trial evidence that could connect education programs to improved long-term outcomes. I think that's not surprising because you wouldn't expect there to be that sort of evidence. And we are now hopeful that, you know, in finding the senior fellow, the economist I mentioned, you know, we'll be in a better position to evaluate some of this, you know, the more complicated literature that could help us better assess this question. I should also say that I think education is an area where, you know, we probably, you know, some observers think, you know, we're sort of making the biggest mistake by, you know, not recommending things in education. So I think the groups that focus on the randomized control trial evidence the Poverty Action Lab at MIT, Innovations Poverty Action at Yale, you know, they do a lot of research on education programs. And I think they would say that, you know, to date we've been, you know, we have made a mistake in not recommending education programs. And, you know, we're certainly open to the idea that we should be. And so that's why we hope to be able to research it in greater depth in the future.
Great. And we have another question from Chuck that is also related to programs that GiveWell hasn't recommended, and that's on ultra-poor graduation models. So Chuck, I'm unmuting you now.
I put it in the note. Just curious if whether you've looked. I know there's been a couple RCTs published on this in the last couple of years, and one of the few cases where there have been multiple. Just wondering if you've looked at it and what your take is on the impact and in particular on the cost effectiveness, because they can be a bit expensive.
Yeah, so we've looked at it a bit, but haven't, you know, fully completed all our work. And so, you know, these are just, I think, just take these as some initial thoughts. Just for background, there is a program where instead of just giving cash, the programs focus on providing some cash, some training, sometimes job training, sometimes training in managing, you know, one's finances, you know, also sometimes an asset transfer, for example, giving someone livestock that could be income generating. And, you know, this program and variations of it were tested in a number, I think 6 or 7 randomized controlled trials around the world over the last 10 years. And so, you know, I think overall, I mean, the first thing is that there was, you know, overall, I think the effects were positive. So they found that, you know, this program had positive effects that I believe surpassed the amounts that were spent on them. There was some variation in the impacts between the trials. So, you know, these were implemented by different organizations in different countries all around the world. And I think in some cases, the effects were significant, and in others, they actually had negative effects. I believe in one case, the livestock that they offered were chickens, and I believe they trained people in, you know, basically chicken care, so that could be a business. And then some disease came through, infection came through, and many of the hens or the chickens died. And so that ended up having, in that trial, a negative effect. So there's certainly some variation. When we looked at it earlier, my recollection is that we saw it as sort of modeled to be slightly more cost effective than GiveDirectly, but that was so slight that we didn't really believe, or we weren't confident enough in that difference to see it as a, you know, a meaningful difference. You know, I've sort of thrown around these numbers, you know, this is more cost effective than that, but, you know, ultimately, all of that comes down to trying to model something with a large number of highly debatable assumptions, often with poor data, and so I think we often see, you know, relatively wide error bars around the estimates that we make. And so in this case, when we sort of modeled it out, the Targeting the Ultra Poor program at the time didn't seem to be outside of that error bar from cash transfers. Finally, you know, I think one of the most interesting claims that the Targeting the Ultra Poor advocates make, and I think it's borne out by some of the evidence, is that the results persist for a very long time. So I know in at least one case, they had a relatively long follow-up. I don't remember now whether it was 4 years or 7 years, but it was significantly longer than the standard follow-up that one would expect to see in a randomized controlled trial in the developing world. And, you know, I think an argument that they might make is, you know, these effects, because they persist, you know, really are even larger than, you know, we had initially modeled them to be. And, you know, that is a point that I'd say I'm unsure about, and I can easily imagine it to be the case. And if we, you know, if and when we go back to these Targeting the Ultra Poor programs, that will be a major focus of our, you know, of our work.
Great, thanks, Ellie. We have another question on GiveDirectly from the EA Australia group. They're asking whether GiveDirectly will give excess funds directed toward its basic, or whether GiveDirectly excess funds directed toward its basic income trial to making the trial bigger or to their usual program?
So GiveDirectly has told us that they expect that they will raise the full funding needed for the size of the basic income trial that they are aiming for. I think that's not fully guaranteed, but they're still working on that fundraising. But as far as donations that are their general pot of donations that they receive from through their website from GiveWell's recommendation, that they expect to use on their traditional model of a one-time $1,000 grant to households.
Great, thanks. We have another question from Kostan, who I'm going to successfully unmute this time.
Hello.
Kostan, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure. Shoot, what's on your mind?
So I guess I'm curious particularly about gender. I've, like I said, the comment there, I've heard again and again that providing aid directly to women in particular, either through cash transfers or education, which I mentioned previously, provided a greater yield on the aid provided than maybe giving directly to men, considering how women maybe in developing nations are more careful or considered about how they use the aid that they're provided. Have you seen results like this, or can you comment on that? Finding from other people?
I have heard the same thing, and I don't recall the specifics of what I've heard about that evidence to comment on it intelligently. So sorry about that.
I've remuted you, Kostan, so let me know if you have any follow-ups in the chat, and I'll unmute you to reduce the echo. Ellie, are you there?
Yep, we're still here. Sorry, I think I didn't hear what you just said.
Oh, great. That Kostan, who asked the question, is on mute right now, and I think that should reduce the echo. So you should go ahead.
Was there what question should I answer? I think I must have missed that. Sorry.
The gender question, or was that was it?
That was it. That's all I have. I know that there's this kind of common conventional wisdom about giving programs or funds to women. And my vague recollection is that didn't hold up under strict scrutiny, but I don't remember the details. So unfortunately, I can't offer more helpful thoughts on that.
Great. Thank you. I think GiveDirectly may be doing a trial that looks at that. I don't believe the results have been available yet. Just looking at it now, they actually ran a small pilot of an informal contract between spouses, and that was last year to look at whether agreeing between spouses affected the outcomes that they agreeing to how they would use the funds, I believe. But they have not completed a larger scale version of that.
Got it. Thanks, Adam. All right, we have another question from EA Australia that's a bit broader, which is, does GiveWell recommend any resources for recommended effective charities outside of the causes of income and health for those who want to donate to particular causes outside of GiveWell's recommendations?
Yeah, so it's a good, it's a good question, and I think it would be something providing some sort of standardized framework would be great if, we think we could do it effectively. I think the challenge is that even within an area as narrow as global health, we think the sorts of questions we need to ask to determine whether a program is effective are even greater than, what we think we could easily standardize. So I think about the questions that, we ask the Against Malaria Foundation, which does malaria nets, and how they differ from the questions that we focus on, you know, with the deworming organizations. You know, I think those make the sort of, you know, more general framework very challenging. And I'd say that when, you know, we think about the mechanism through which we could have impact beyond the scale of just the research that we're able to do in-house, you know, one of the ways is hoping that by being so transparent, by trying to show the model of how one can do deep research on charitable programs and organizations, you know, other groups can then pick this up and, you know, hopefully assess other sorts of organizations that are beyond the scope of what GiveWell looks at. And I think one good example of this is an organization called Animal Charities Evaluators, you know, which I think very much is modeled after GiveWell's approach, you know, though obviously, you know, different in, you know, in their, in what works in their cause, but, you know, takes the general attitude that we do, but then applies that to a different area. And I think that is one way that we're, you know, excited about, you know, other groups kind of leading this forward and covering more organizations.
Great, thanks. And I'm going to ask a follow-up on behalf of EA Australia, which is also sort of just related to GiveWell's approach, which is that you've spoken about the various characteristics of measuring impact across different charities. Does GiveWell see any value in developing a standardized framework for measuring this impact, i.e. a benchmark, in order to show the merit in your recommendations going forward? What would be the challenges you see in creating such a framework?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the key challenge is that, you know, the more having, if I'm understanding the question correctly, you know, having that sort of benchmark would require, you know, a really well quantified impact that one is willing to rely on. And so, you know, right now we use the benchmark of we compare the organizations that, you know, we recommend to cash. And so we'll say something like, you know, and if you look in our blog post on our recommendations, we'll say, well, we estimate that Malaria Consortium's Seasonal Malaria Chemo Prevention Program and the Against Malaria Foundation's work are four times as cost effective as cash transfers. And, you know, we think that is a useful benchmark to have, though, you know, we also fear highlighting that figure too much because it is so fraught, subject to both difficult assumptions, but also philosophical judgment calls. So in that case, for example, we're literally trying to compare the impact that the malaria-focused organizations have, which is saving lives, to the impact that the that a cash transfer has, which is increasing immediate consumption and long-term income. And there, that's not the sort of you know, the sort of trade-off that is one can make objectively or mathematically. Instead, it's subject to this, you know, very difficult judgment call about weighing those two benefits against one another. And so therefore, you know, we do try to use a benchmark where we can because we think it's helpful and useful context, but also are hesitant to put too much emphasis on it because we think it may lead people to think that the conclusions that we've reached and the numbers that we've assigned, frankly, are more certain and more objective than we deem them to be.
Great, thanks, Ellie. There is another question from Chuck about family planning. So Chuck, I'm going to unmute your line now.
Oh, it was just, have you taken a close look at any of the family planning programs? And they're not on your list, but have you found anything that's promising that you're continuing to look at?
You know, we haven't taken a close look at family planning programs. You know, one of the reasons, I mean, I think another another theme that runs through our recommendations so far is that they tend to be, you know, relatively straightforward, you know, relatively easy to deliver. They don't require significant behavior change in order to make them work. I guess bed nets is the closest where it requires that someone puts up a net every single night. You know, the other, certainly deworming, is just administering a pill one or two times a year. And so, you know, many family planning programs have this inherent challenge of requiring some degree of behavior change in addition to just providing access to commodities or other services for them to work. I will say that one program that we came across last year and is something we do sometimes talk about internally, and I hope we get to look at next year addresses some of these challenges. And it's a program called Sayana Press, and I believe it was developed out of an organization named PATH, and it's now being implemented at least by the organization PSI, formerly known as Population Services International. And it's a injectable 3-month contraceptive. And so it, and I believe the, I think the innovation here was that it was particularly easy and safe to inject and didn't require the same sorts of infrastructure that other injectable contraceptives might have. So I could be wrong about that. But regardless, Sayana Press is a program that's definitely on our minds as one that, you know, we'd like to look at in the near future, and is certainly something that we might end up talking a lot about next year.
I was going to ask about that in particular. You probably know this, Ellie, but Children's Investment Fund have been a funder of that, and have done a deep dive on it, and could probably give you a running start.
That's great. Yeah, thanks.
Great. And we have a couple of future-looking questions. And I'm going to ask the first on behalf of Lauren, which is, how do you anticipate the Trump administration will have an impact on your work going forward?
Good question. I think the two immediate reactions that come to mind, I mean, first is there's been, you know, some talk about how changes in tax rates could affect levels of charitable giving. You know, that's not something that we pay a lot of attention to. You know, I think that we as an organization are still very much in growth mode. And so, you know, kind of small changes in how much people give would probably not have a major effect on the work that we do. I think the other possibility that's easy to imagine is changes in the U.S. government's, commitments to foreign aid. And I have very little knowledge of, what might happen, but it's not hard to imagine those commitments changing. And the U.S. government is a major funder of, you know, many global health and development programs that are extremely effective, major funder of bed nets, funder of deworming programs, in addition to other things. And so I think that another thing that, you know, we will be watching is, you know, any indication that funding from the U.S. government or, frankly, other world governments that have similarly undergone major changes recently could affect the, you know, funding needs either for the interventions we recommend or interventions that, you know, we've looked at but have not recommended in the past because we felt like they already had sufficient levels of funding.
Great. Thank you. And another question looking forward from the EA Australia retreat is, does Gipple have any plans or suggestions on how to increase transparency within charities to allow easier evaluation?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think where I think this question is coming from is I think we've certainly found it sometimes challenging to get as many organizations to seek our recommendation and apply for our recommendation as we would like. Certainly as our name recognition has grown and the amount of funding that we can direct has risen, we've gotten, you know, it's been much easier to get organizations to engage with us. But we still have a fair amount that, you know, choose not to, that don't want to participate. And so, you know, this is one of the challenges we'd also like to solve for next year. And so one of the things that, you know, when we think about the obstacles that might cause organizations to not participate, you know, we see a few. I mean, so sort of obstacle number one is, you know, I think groups may just be a little fearful or may see some friction when we approach them. And, you know, even though we say, you know, we're not putting anything on the record until you give us permission to, you know, just the fact that we're out there writing things publicly, I think, you know, may cause groups a little bit of concern. And so one idea, so that's kind of challenge number one. And then I think challenge number two is, I think that, I've been surprised by how many organizations are not aware of the, you know, the value proposition, so to speak, that GiveWell offers. You know, that if they run programs, if they have operations that are a good fit for our recommendations, meaning the programs have strong evidence and are cost effective, they have some monitoring and they're willing to share it with us, you know, they have a fairly good chance at receiving significant funding. In 2015, our last year where we had, you know, tracked this for a full year, we directed more than $100 million to our recommendations. And, you know, that was split among four organizations. You know, some of them received, you know, obviously tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, I think that we just need to make sure that organizations really understand the process and the, you know, potential value. And so one of the things we're also thinking about is having a dedicated staff member whose job is really to be the, in a sense, the liaison and the internal advocate for organizations. And the idea is that the staff member could travel to see organizations, could really engage with them, explain our process, explain the value proposition, and have all that happen outside of the strict evaluation that we do, you know, with the hopes that, you know, if there are organizations that could be really, you know, really excellent, that, you know, we're able to encourage them to come forward. And I say that, you know, when we think about how to ease evaluation, you know, that's really what we want to do. We want, you know, more organizations to know that if they're running the sorts of programs we are looking for, that they should share information with us, and, you know, it's probably in, you know, in their best interest.
Great. Thanks, Ellie. There are no more questions in the queue, so it might be time to wrap up. As a reminder to everyone, this we're planning to post the audio from the call on our website. So if you have any concerns with that or questions, definitely reach out to us to let us know. Or if you have any follow-up questions, please also feel free to reach out to ask them. We're happy to stay in touch.
Yeah, and you know, just want to add, and while I do, I mean, we're happy to stick around a bit longer if folks have more questions. So if anything comes to mind, you know, feel free to throw it in the chat on the conference call or send it to info@givewell.org. You know, but in the meantime, you know, just wanted to say how much we, you know, appreciate people who are interested in jumping on a conference call and talking about charity recommendations. It's, you know, it's something that the sort of intellectual discourse around charitable giving is something that is so limited. And so it's, you know, it's really exciting to see a group of people that want to engage, ask questions, and, you know, really find out what, you know, what we can do to, you know, give as effectively as possible. So thank you. We really appreciate it.
All right. It looks like we have a couple final questions coming in the last minute. So, Costa, one more from you. So I'm going to unmute you now. I know we've had an echoing issue, so I'm probably going to remute you after you ask the question, and just ping me if you would like to ask any follow-ups.
Hi. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I was just curious about kind of the operating budget of GiveWell and how much it requires to sustain your operations and what kind of stuff you spend your money on. Thanks so much for doing this call. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Good question, and totally our pleasure. You know, we want to share our research with as many, you know, people who are interested in it. On the operating budget. So, you know, if you look at our public budgets, either on our website or in our tax forms, you may get a little bit of a misleading picture, because, you know, GiveWell right now combines the work of both GiveWell, where we're looking at our sort of standard top charities research that we've been talking about, but also the Open Philanthropy Project, which is a, you know, another research project that we work on in partnership with Good Ventures. It's an entity that we're planning to spin out of GiveWell, you know, within the next year, certainly. And, you know, its staff is still all included in sort of on the official books of GiveWell. So all the figures I'm going to give you are going to come from are just focused on the GiveWell research specifically, sort of regardless of the open philanthropy side, though I could certainly talk about that too if it's interesting. So GiveWell is approximately 20 staff, about half of whom are focused on research and about half of whom are focused on operations. And, you know, we have one dedicated staff member on outreach. The vast majority of our expenses are our staff costs. You know, we have other costs like the ones you mentioned, you know, web hosting and an office. But, you know, really it's salaries for staff that form the vast majority of our costs, where half of that staff is research and half of that is sort of operations and other. And I should say the total operating budget right now is, you know, roughly $2 million. And so one of the things that we think about is, you know, what's a reasonable operating expense for, you know, a group that directs as much funding as we do. And so, you know, we think we kind of compare the $2 million operating budget to the, you know, roughly $100 million that we directed. And, you know, that sort of 2% ratio we think compares well to, you know, other entities that are you know, giving out funding like major foundations.
Great. Thanks, Ellie. Couple more questions from the EA Australia retreat. The first is, can you think of any kinds of nonprofits which you suspect may be doing effective work, but GiveWell does not recommend because the good they do is measure/verify?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of organizations that might be doing, that are doing outstanding work, and GiveWell doesn't recommend them because of our criteria. I mean, I think one place to look for that, you know, or that sort of thing would be the type of work that the Open Philanthropy Project supports. You know, GiveWell really is trying to fill the niche that is the combination of maximum impact while also having recommendations that are, you know, any outside observer can understand and verify and vet without, you know, special knowledge, experience, or insight, and without trusting our judgment. So I think there's a whole class of groups that are, you know, sort of very much outside the scope of GiveWell and could be really excellent. And, you know, we think it's yeah, I mean, so that, I mean, I think that's definitely, you know, definitely a possibility.
Great. And the second question is, how do you decide where to look next for effective interventions? Do you ask experts in different fields in health or just scan journals yourself?
So it's really a combination of sort of everything we possibly can do. So, you know, we are scanning journals ourselves. So, you know, we have alerts set up for, you know, for major global health and development journals where we're just trying to find out about, you know, anything that's the next interesting thing. You know, similarly, we, you know, will periodically have a staff member attend conferences that are, you know, where people are presenting new research, where researchers are talking about the ideas they're most excited about, and we'll try to take information back from them that could feed into our process about which interventions to focus on. We also will reach out to, you know, individual charitable organizations, or organizations will reach out to us. So I mentioned a couple interventions on this call that I think we, you know, frankly, initially heard about by groups coming to us and saying, you know, we think we're a good fit for your research. Here are the programs that we run that we think are most cost effective. And, you know, we could really utilize additional funding for that. So I believe that the way that the seasonal malaria chemo prevention program initially got on our radar is that a representative of Malaria Consortium joined this conference call a year ago. And after that call, you know, we got in contact with them. They believed that they were a good fit. I mean, they rightly believed that they were a good fit for our process. They gave us a list of 10 or so programs to look at. You know, we tried to figure out which one would be the most likely one to be a good fit in the time that we had, and we focused on seasonal malaria chemo prevention. And, you know, we basically got that idea from them, and we've had a similar experience with other organizations as well. And so going forward, you know, we're also intending to go out to, you know, some of the larger aid organizations, especially ones that I think have a, you know, what I perceive to be a, you know, sort of the attitude or the characteristic that Malaria Consortium has, which is having research be really very much part of the DNA and the comparative advantage of the organization, and say to those groups, you know, you tell us, you know, what interventions do you think, you know, you have that would meet our criteria, you know, evidence-backed, cost-effective, and need additional funding. And so that's another way that we get, you know, more ideas into the, you know, sort of into the, on the list. And then finally, I mean, we do hear from, you know, people in the effective altruism community as well. And so when people send us, you know, I see names on the call of people who, you know, I know have sent in ideas to us before. You know, we really want people to, you know, send ideas to us if they think they are, you know, worth our considering. And, you know, the better that people know us and the more that they're able to, you know, explain to us why they think the recommendations they're making to us are, you know, ones we should take seriously, the easier it is for us to decide what to look into. I mean, we very much are sitting here saying, you know, we have our criteria, and within those criteria, we would like to find the most effective things to recommend. So, you know, if you're on the call right now and think there are things that meet the criteria I've laid out, but we haven't covered them, you know, please let me know that, you know, we should, because we'd really like to hear from you. I mean, I think the folks on this call are probably the group of people who, you know, outside of GiveWell staff have some of the best understanding of, you know, what we're trying to do. And so to the extent that you can share those ideas with us, we'd really appreciate it.
All right. And that's all for the questions in the queue. So thank you all very, very much for joining. As Ellie said, it's a really exciting call and hear people's questions, and we really appreciate your engagement with the research that we do.
Yeah, thank you so much. And, you know, as always, feel free to email any additional questions into us, you know, later on. We're really happy to answer them. You know, we think answering these questions both helps our research get better, but is also very much a part of, you know, the, you know, our core mission to educate donors about how to do as much good as possible with their charitable donations.
Great. Thank you all.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night and afternoon all. We really appreciate it.